Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. In the United States, it's estimated that one of every six males is the victim of sexual abuse. That means an estimated 20 million men may be suffering the after effects of such as depression, substance abuse, suicidal thoughts. The sexual abuse allegations against retired Penn State football coach Jerry Sandusky have raised many questions. Why was it not reported long ago? And if the allegations are true, what can we do to prevent it from happening again? Later this hour, we'll talk with a criminal defense attorney about the legal rights of individuals accused of child sex abuse. We'll also hear from an attorney who represents the interests of the abused. Joining us now is psychologist Howard Fradkin. He's a co-founder of Male Survivor and co-chairperson of the Male Survivor Weekends of Recovery. He has counseled more than 1,000 male survivors of sexual abuse during his 28-year career. He's also trained hundreds of professional colleagues on the topic of psychotherapy with male survivors of sexual abuse. Welcome back to the show, Howard.
Thank you, Ann. It's a privilege to be here.
I want to let our listeners know the website address. It's malesurvivor.org, malesurvivor.org. And it'll also be posted at our website at wosu.org/allsides. Also joining us is Scott. He's a survivor of childhood sexual abuse who, as an adult, reported the abuse and whose abuser was found guilty and sentenced to prison. Welcome to the show, Scott.
Thank you.
Question for our listeners. In the wake of the Penn State scandal, Pennsylvania legislators are introducing bills to strengthen requirements for reporting allegations of child sex abuse. Do you think we need to strengthen reporting requirements in Ohio? Would you feel better if people in the position of Jerry Sandusky were watched more closely, and that someone in the role of the grad student who says that he saw him abusing a child would have been compelled to report the abuse by law? Give us a call, 614-292-8513. Or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org, and you can go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page and post it there as well. Howard Fradkin, when something like this happens, when a case like this comes to light and has the entire nation talking about child sex abuse, is it good or bad for all the other victims out there?
Well, it's good for all victims in the sense that we all benefit from people being much more aware that children are abused, and especially that boys are abused. Boys have pretty much been the invisible survivors. Unfortunately, this kind of media attention has also had a lot of downside because many survivors, both male and female, have been re-traumatized because just hearing all this makes them think about their own abuse. It also has the potential to make them really angry and upset at the media and at some of the coverage that has not focused at all on the impact of the victims, but rather is focused on, you know, the impact on Penn State.
Yes, because in this case, it's celebrity that's involved as well. How does that play into the dynamic?
Well, Jerry Sandusky is, you know, obviously a very powerful guy, as is Joe Paterno, and unfortunately, they abused their power. Well, Jerry Sandusky abused his power. And
allegedly.
Mm-hmm. And he's been charged with that. And Joe Paterno had an opportunity to do more. He did report it, which was good. But, you know, one way to think about this is if somebody had walked by a shower and there was a man abusing a girl, there's no doubt that people would be extremely uncomfortable with that. And they would have immediately reported it. There would have been no question that it would have gotten reported, no matter who it was.
So what is it about the abuse of boys that doesn't elicit the same kind of reaction?
Well, I think if it's a male abusing another male, unfortunately what happens is people project that that's a homosexual act. And still many people, despite all of our progress, are very uncomfortable with homosexuality. The reality is it's not a homosexual act. It's not a sex act at all. It's an act of violence. It's an act of rape. It's a crime. But people get very uncomfortable about that, and I think that silences people, along with the fact that Jerry Sandusky had a lot of power there, so that the first people who saw him were janitors, and I think they were afraid for their jobs. They were afraid what would happen if they reported it. And that's an institutional responsibility in my mind. But Jerry Sandusky knew that he had that much power. I mean, it's incredible that he did that in such a public place.
My guest is Howard Fracken. He's a psychologist and co-founder of Male Survivor. If you want to learn more about that organization, malesurvivor.org is the website. You can also go to our website at wosu.org/allsides. Also with us, Scott. He's a survivor of childhood sexual abuse. He's had an adult. As an adult, he reported the abuse, and his abuser was found guilty and sentenced to prison. Scott, you were abused by an older member of your extended family back in the 1970s when you were about 7 years old. Had you been educated at all before that about pedophiles and the signs of child abuse?
Not really. It wasn't a discussion that you would hear in the schools or whatnot. We were warned to watch out for stranger danger and all that type of stuff like they teach kids now, but there's nothing out there to prepare you for being perpetrated by somebody that you know or look up to or respect, or somebody, like for me it was a family member, but if it's somebody in a leadership role, what do you do with that?
Did anyone besides your abuser know or have a clue about what was happening when you look back on it?
I don't think so. I think I was always a shy child, so my personality probably didn't change that much at that time. And I didn't tell anybody about it. It was our special secret. That's how he played it up to me. And I didn't want to get him in trouble because he was somebody who was special in my life. And so I didn't tell anybody, and I just carried the secret through school. And it had very difficult repercussions on my life. But no, I don't think that anybody else was aware at that time.
Is that typical, Howard Fracken, that the victim feels somewhat protective of the abuser?
Oh, absolutely. It's very common that victims feel loyal to their perpetrators. As Scott was saying, in his case, it was something special. In Jerry Sandusky's case, I mean, he was treating these young boys to all sorts of special treats that any boy in there, especially because these were disadvantaged kids, I mean, the kind of gifts that he was giving them, taking them to football games, having them sit at the coach's table, sleeping over at his house. I mean, these are all big deals to these kids. So it's quite understandable that they felt very loyal to him, which is why some of them are feeling guilty today.
The descriptions in the indictment against Jerry Sandusky describe a lot of, from what I can tell of them, pretty classic grooming techniques. They don't immediately start to rape the child. There's some time before that where they build up to it.
Absolutely. That's very, very common that there's grooming that goes on. And grooming is any kind of behavior that makes the child believe that this person cares about them, that he likes them, that he wants to do special things with them, gives them special treats. And so they win over their loyalty. They win over the child's silence, essentially, because the child won't speak up, like Scott's saying, because he didn't want to get him in trouble, and he was liking the specialness of not the abuse, but liking the specialness of the treatment.
Scott, was that the case for you?
Yeah, absolutely. The grooming with me started with tickling and touching in inappropriate places. I was very needy as a child. I very much needed attention because I wasn't getting it from my peers and whatnot at school. So he was a special person in my life. He used to play with me all the time and pay a lot of attention to me. As the grooming progressed, he would pay less and less attention to me unless I let him do things. And that's how he eventually took full advantage of me, right?
Howard, what do we know about the abusers? Is this something very conscious on their part necessarily? Or is it such an organic process for them too that they're not aware necessarily?
I would say that it's a very conscious process, that they know that in order to get away with this, they have to do certain behaviors in order to win over the child. So I think it's very much a conscious process for most of them. I don't think it's organic at all.
Scott?
Yeah, and I would very much agree with that. It was interesting after the fact, after I prosecuted, this was my grandfather, but he, every time we were done, he always forced me to go take a bath. I always had to take a shower or a bath after every incident. And I know now that that was because he wanted to eliminate any forensic evidence.
A common question at times like these is, why didn't anybody report this back when they were a child? And so, you know, not that you represent everybody out there, everybody has their own reasons, but Scott, you waited until you were an adult, till your early 20s, to report it. I want to know why you did it then, but why didn't you do it as a child?
Mm-hmm. Well, when I was a child, I mean, that person was my entire life. I think a lot of it depends on your scope or your context at the time, right? Now the world is a much bigger place, and I have the resources and whatnot and the knowledge to see what was wrong. At that time, I felt that something wasn't quite right because I didn't see my friends experiencing these things. But it was still our special secret, and he used it to make me feel good emotionally. So I wouldn't have reported it at that time. I had to actually leave home down to college and be away from the situation a while and gain more life experience before I even fully understood how bad the situation was and what had occurred.
So what did trigger the decision to go to the prosecutor and file charges?
I was actually witnessing, when I go back up for visits and whatnot, situations that appeared as though he was grooming other family members. And I had to do something because it appeared that it was getting closer and closer to happening to them. So I wanted to make sure that that did not happen.
Howard Fredkin, I would imagine that's a very common trigger in anyone who's compassionate and looks back and doesn't want it to happen to somebody else.
Absolutely. You know, survivors take childhood sexual abuse very seriously, and few, if any, would ever want another child to be hurt.
In fact, it's very rare that somebody actually becomes an abuser themselves. Some do, but it's not what people think often.
That is right. It's a rare occurrence, but it does occur, unfortunately, because for some people, that is the way that they're attempting to manage their own abuse.
Scott, when all this news broke last week, what went through your mind? I asked Howard Fredkin at the top, you know, what kind of impact that can have, but what kind of impact did it have on you?
It triggers a lot of anxiety for me. I obviously feel for anybody that's in this situation, whether it's the victims or the parents or just anybody involved at all. It's an extremely difficult situation to be in. And when I hear about these things, it does remind me of the difficult times that I went through. And not that I put my family through anything, but the difficulties that they went through dealing with this with me. So it concerns me for all the people involved.
We're going to return, and when we do, we will continue our conversation with Howard Fredkin and also Scott, who's a survivor of child sex abuse. And we will be bringing in an attorney who represents people like Scott when they decide to report the abuse. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News, and you can listen to our station anytime by streaming on the web. Just visit WOSU.org and click on the Listen Now button at the top of the page. Listen to local and national news from your computer or mobile device. Just visit WOSU.org.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Physicians Free Clinic and Voluntary Care Network, providing charity medical care for Central Ohio's uninsured patients. More about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation and supporting the clinic is at goodhealthcolumbus.org.
53 degrees in downtown Columbus. Expect showers throughout the morning, cloudy skies in the afternoon, a high near 55. Mostly cloudy tonight, a little chilly, a low of 31 degrees. Clouds for Thursday, maybe a little sunshine peeking through those clouds, and a high of 44 degrees. And then clear skies Thursday night and cold, a low of just 26. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Today on All Sides, we're talking about the issues raised by the Penn State child sex abuse scandal. What is the moral and legal responsibility to report suspected child abuse? And what can we do to prevent sexual abuse and support the victims? Later this hour, we'll talk with a local criminal defense attorney about the legal rights of individuals accused of child sex abuse. Still with us is psychologist Howard Fracken. He's co-founder of Male Survivor. He's counseled hundreds of survivors of sexual abuse. Howard, once again, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Anne.
Also with us still is Scott. He's a survivor of sexual abuse. His abuser was eventually found guilty and sentenced to prison. Joining us now is attorney Beverly Farlow of Farlow & Associates. She represents victims of child sex abuse. She has been named an Ohio Super Lawyer for 2006, 7, 8, and 9. Welcome to the show, Beverly.
Thank you very much, Anne.
So how do the laws protect victims of child sex abuse after they become adults?
Oh, good question. There are still criminal penalties that apply, and there certainly are civil remedies that apply. The statute of limitations on criminal matters is 20 years from the date of the occurrence. And then with civil matters, as of August 3rd of 2006, when the statute changed, it's within 12 years of the child reaching the age of 18. So adults still have a remedy up until the age of 30.
How common or how typical is it that civil civil charges are filed as well, or that there's a civil case along with the criminal? Is it pretty typical?
Boy, typical is hard to say because mm-hmm. every case is very different. It's so important for a victim to understand what legal remedies are available because legal remedies can be very complicated, and trying to avail yourself of a civil remedy without an attorney can be very confusing. So once the criminal decision is made, that's turned over to the prosecutor of the county where the victim resides or where the offense occurred. But when it comes to a civil matter, then the civil remedy is something that the victim has to be very careful in selecting. One of the things that people have to be very honest with themselves about, and I think Howard is talking about this as well, is whether they're truly ready to go forward. Because sometimes the statute of limitations is looming and you're thinking, oh gosh, if I don't do something, then I'm going to be precluded from having a remedy, but the victim still is not ready to go forward.
Howard, how do you counsel somebody in that case when they're on that, in that dilemma?
It's really important that they are ready, as Beverly was saying, and that means psychologically ready, because this is a very, very difficult process to go forward. It's tremendously stressful, anxiety-producing. The survivor oftentimes has to put their entire personal life and life history, sexual history, in the public domain, even though apparently there are some protections against that, but oftentimes that's not what occurs. And so they really need to be prepared and ready to decide if they can tolerate that. And furthermore, they really need to be clear enough that the abuse clearly was not in any way, shape, or form their fault. Because a lot of times what happens is people are not yet there. They haven't fully resolved it. They're still blaming themselves. And then they decide to press charges against their perpetrator. And if they succeed, then they might feel guilty afterwards. Much like some of the guys at Penn State, I think, are already feeling, even though there haven't been any decisions made, just filing the charges themselves, some of them are already feeling guilty, like, oh my gosh, what did we do?
Scott, what was the leap for you from just warning your family and telling them about it, which would be stressful enough, and going to a prosecutor and pressing charges?
That's actually a really good question. I never thought of that. I don't know. As a result of all of this, I have a lot of trust issues of the people around me. So I don't want to say that I didn't trust that my family wouldn't protect me, but I knew that I needed to get him out of the situation, or I needed to get him away from the kids. And I didn't necessarily trust that that would have occurred if I just told people about it. The only way that I could be positive that it would stop is to get him gone, and make sure that even if it's not my family members being perpetrated against, it would probably be somebody else. And he's out of prison now, so it probably is occurring now. So the only thing that I could do was get him off the streets for as long as I possibly could.
David from Clintonville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, David. Hello, David.
Hi.
Hi.
I lived with a woman for 7 years, and it was a very close relationship. We're not together anymore. But when she was abused as a child, and I, of course, when I found out about it, was very fired up, and tell everybody, and, you know, my sister's a social worker, and her position was, unburden yourself, release yourself. These things will build up and leak and cause problems. And but the situation was that she hadn't said anything for a very long time, maybe 30, 40 years. And the only other person who was abused was her sister, was a family member. I never found out who, the big family. Mm-hmm. But eventually the sister died in a freak car accident. And that removed really the only person who could back her up on this. And the family was tightly knit and would support everybody in it. And I was pretty sure that if she said anything, the family would back up the guy. And so her position was not to say anything, just let it slide.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think there might have been some problem in terms of another family member possibly being a victim too, and that was part of my concern.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of her health, I'm not sure that keeping it quiet in the end might not have been the best thing. I've read situations where somebody outs somebody and the family doesn't believe them,
mm-hmm.
and then of course now they're an outcast, and you know. So I just wondered whether the psychologist had to say about that.
Howard Fracken?
I think that in some cases it could be better to keep it to yourself and work on your own healing and not speak. And oftentimes people need to do that for a very long time until they're ready. I think it's really important when you're ready to be able to start talking. And the sooner you can talk, really, the better it is. It's very possible, and in what you're saying, very possible that her family would have turned against her. And that's a very difficult situation. I talk to people that recovery is about learning to be loyal to functionality and disloyal to dysfunction. So when you're in a dysfunctional family and you're perpetrated, you learn to be loyal to dysfunction. And the trick is to learn how to be loyal to functionality, which is when you get to speak your truth and when you get to behave in ways that are healthy for you. But that's a long process.
You're just joining us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. And my guests are Howard Fracken, psychologist and co-founder of Male Survivor. Also, attorney Beverly Farlow. She represents victims of child sex abuse. And our guest as well, Scott. He's a survivor of child sex abuse. If you have a question or comment for any of our guests, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Beverly Farlow, in these kinds of cases, were the families pitted against the accuser, against the abused person? How do you handle that as a lawyer? What do you recommend how they manage their family issues?
Well, I guess, first of all, I should say at the outset that in most situations that I've been a part of, the family has not turned against the okay. accuser. And that's very fortunate, because once that happens, then it's so important for that person to find support in some kind of relationship network for the litigation process. And if it's not going to be family, then certainly turning to a person such as Howard and the network that he has established would be extremely helpful. So that's what you need to do, because litigation, you have to have your deposition taken. You have to share confidences that really you haven't shared for your entire adult life. You're very vulnerable in that process. So it's very important that you find a substitute support network.
Scott, did you put together a team like that of support that got you through this? And also, how did your family respond, and were they supportive?
I was fortunate. Most of my family responded in a positive fashion, as positive as it could be, right? Mm-hmm. There was a couple of them. I did receive death threats indirectly that if I did anything, they'd kill me, or they killed the other people that I cared about, that type of thing. Fortunately, nothing like that was tried. So my family was supportive, but I should have had a better, I always, since I'm such a loner anyway, I always do everything on my own. I didn't have a really good support network then. I was in therapy, thank goodness. So I was working it out that way, but the proceedings and whatnot, I did all of that stuff by myself. And I would encourage folks that are looking at that avenue to make sure that they have somebody going in there with them, and be selective on who you tell these things to.
I would imagine litigation for anything is stressful, mm-hmm. let alone something like this. Do you advise that, Beverly, if you have a client who's not in counseling, who doesn't seem to have that kind of support, is that something you talk to them about?
Oh, yes. That's something that we talk about at the very beginning of the case and try to explain how demanding the litigation process is. It's very easy for an attorney to say, you know, you let me worry about the legal case. That's my responsibility. You just go about and live your life. But I think in these kinds of cases, it's not that easily said. This is not like a contract dispute about a car, for heaven's sakes. This is something that goes to the very core of who you are as a person. So as an attorney, I would invariably discuss that thoroughly and repeatedly with my clients. And most often, I essentially make continuing in counseling a condition of my representation, because I can be the attorney, but I'm not competent to be the counselor for the person. I'm a counselor at law, but I'm not a psychotherapist.
Pennsylvania state lawmakers, of course, are, you know, falling all over each other, introducing bills to strengthen requirements for reporting allegations of child sex abuse. What do you think, Beverly, if anything, that lawmakers could do to address these issues to make it fair?
Well, they've already done that in Ohio.
You feel have been done as best they can?
Yeah, we have the mandatory rebuke. Mandatory child abuse reporting statutes that attach actually criminal penalties for mandatory reporters who do not report. And the definition of mandatory reporter, and by the way, this is for people who know or suspect that abuse has occurred. These mandatory reporters include not just teachers and ministers and daycare providers, but all the way through the list of licensed professionals in the state of Ohio. And by mandatory, that means the person must report instances of abuse when the person knows or suspects, of course. There are also permissive reporters that anyone basically who reasonably knows or suspects of abuse can turn someone in. But professionals have an especially strong duty to turn someone in because, and by turn them in, I mean the report has to be to the child protection agencies in the counties or to law enforcement personnel. Just reporting up the chain, maybe to a school principal or maybe to a member of the Board of Education, that's really not sufficient in Ohio. The statute is very specific about who, for example, a teacher needs to report to, and it's the Protective Services Agency or law enforcement authorities, and there's what we call a grant of immunity to good faith reporters, so that someone who makes a good faith report that abuse has occurred is not going to have to be concerned with facing penalties if it doesn't turn out to be true. Mm-hmm. Also, the person who makes the report needs to be assured that their names are held confidentially by statute. The only way the name of a reporter can be brought forth is if a child actually dies, and then it's within the discretion of certain state agencies whether that confidentiality would be broken. But in all other instances, the identity of the accuser is held sacred.
I read the list of who falls into the category of reporters who are legally bound to report, and it's very broad. And I was wondering, do you feel confident that all these people out there that fill all these categories are fully aware of what the law is and are properly trained in what their obligations are?
I think the operative word in your question is training. Some people are, some people aren't. You know, I, for one, did not know that people who work for humane societies are mandatory reporters. So it never hurts to go back and look at the statute again to see who's covered. But for people who are in positions of responsibility for children, they need to inform themselves about whether they're covered as mandatory reporters, because with great probability they absolutely are.
Shannon in Delaware, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Shannon.
Hi. I'm really happy that you all are discussing this. I am 34 years old and was sexually abused by my granddad, Justice Scott. I was 9 when it occurred, and my statute of limitation, by the time that I had reported it to family, had run out for the state that I was living in. But I just want everyone to remember that this, once it's reported, it's not over with. This is a lifelong trauma that can be triggered by a million things. And it's something that we will be living with as survivors the rest of our lives.
Howard?
That is absolutely true. And I'm glad that you made that point, Shannon. And I also feel it's really important to tell survivors that recovery is absolutely possible, and that it's possible to get to a place where you're thriving maybe 10% of the time, 20%, 50%, and each day can get better as you can speak your truth. And I really honor your being able to do that this morning.
Well, thank you very much, and I agree. It does get easier every time I can tell my story, and the more people are willing to listen, that helps too.
Shannon, you know, some people are saying, why are you talking about this again? You know, we're sick of talking about Jerry Sandusky. What's your view of that?
I was really hurt at the very beginning. As a matter of fact, told my husband to turn off the television because it brings up memories and it brings up feelings. And when it first broke, I was really concerned because nobody was talking about the kids. There were some children that will forever be in a position like myself, where every single day something could happen. You could walk down the road, you could see a person that looks like your abuser, and you could be taken to a place. And I do not think that we need to stop talking about this, because this happens and it affects our lives. I have 2 children of my own that I am so worried about all the time. And I have a husband who has to deal with a dysfunctional wife. And that's one of those things that happens. I think we forget the ones who were directly affected by what has allegedly occurred.
Absolutely, I agree with that the media did a horrible job at the beginning. And, I mean, yesterday when Jerry Sandusky was paraded around with his lawyer to make his TV interviews, I thought, oh my gosh, survivors around the country are probably screaming and yelling and hollering and being really pissed off and upset as are the victims of his crimes.
Mm-hmm.
Shannon, thanks so much for your call.
Thank you.
Take good care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Scott, any thoughts, final thoughts before we move on?
Well, for me, when the news initially broke, I had the same response. I thought I was very upset that people were rioting because their coach got thrown out and not because these kids were abused. I'm glad to see that things are changing and going in the right direction. I think that this is, well, it's a horrible situation. I think it's could be used in a good way by keeping these conversations going and getting people talking about these things, because that's part of the problem, is that nobody talks about this stuff. It is kept in the closet, and nobody wants to address the issue, and we really do need to talk about this stuff and make people aware of what's going on in our communities.
Thanks so much for joining us today, Scott. We really appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
Scotty's a survivor of child sexual abuse, and also Howard Fredkin. Thanks so much for joining us again, Howard.
Thank you, Anne. Appreciate the opportunity, and please keep talking about this.
Howard Fredkin's a psychologist and co-founder of Male Survivor. If you want to learn more about that organization, malesurvivor.org is the website address. And also, Beverly Farlow, thanks for joining us and telling us about the Ohio laws, Beverly.
My pleasure.
Beverly Farlow is founder and principal of Farlow & Associates. So when we return, we'll hear from an attorney who represents people who are accused of child sex abuse. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Supporting 89.7 NPR News is easier than ever when you become a sustaining member. Sign up online at wosu.org/sustainer. As a sustaining member, your donation is automatic, monthly, and ongoing. No more letters in the mail, and your WOSU member card will renew automatically. Every year, we'll confirm your membership, and you can cancel at any time. For as little as $5 per month, you'll be supporting the programs you love. Become a sustaining member now at wosu.org/sustainer.
This is 89.7 NPR News. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, Hour 2 of All Sides begins, and a discussion of living with wild turkeys. Also asking the question, are raccoons getting smarter? Join us for this wildlife discussion from 11 till noon on All Sides with Ann Fisher. 53 degrees in downtown Columbus with some rain. The rain should be letting up in a little bit here. Cloudy skies and a high of 55 degrees. Clouds for tonight, a low of 31. Some clouds for Thursday, and then sunshine in the afternoon, a high of 44 degrees. Clear skies Thursday night and cold, a low of 26. And sunshine as we look ahead to Friday, and a high near 50. You can receive daily updates from WOSU by liking our station on Facebook or by following WOSU News on Twitter. Another way to connect with us is by subscribing to our daily News Loop e-newsletter. Just visit wosu.org/email to sign up. And All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
I believe in Jerry's innocence. Quite honestly, Bob, that's why I'm involved in the case. If I thought
you believe in his innocence.
His innocence.
Not just that you can mitigate his guilt. You believe in his innocence.
I believe in his innocence.
That was Bob Costas interviewing attorney Joe Amendola. He is representing former Penn State University assistant football coach Jerry Sandusky, who is accused of serial child abuse over a period of many years. What are the legal rights of an individual accused of child sex abuse, and what legal issues are raised when the witness is a child or the case involves an accusation of childhood abuse from long ago? Joining us now is Stephen Palmer, a criminal defense attorney and co-founder of Yavich & Palmer Company. Stephen focuses his practice in many areas, including domestic violence, misdemeanors, and sexual assault. His firm defends individuals accused of sexual assault, including child sexual abuse. Welcome to the show, Stephen. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Jerry Sandusky's lawyer says that he believes his client is not guilty of the charges in the 40-count indictment. Is that always the case for a defense lawyer? Can you defend somebody without believing they're not guilty?
Yeah. Is that always the case? I think no, quite the contrary. You know, a lot of what we do is defend people and help them with their situations. And, you know, people ask all the time, how do you defend people that you know are guilty? Well, it happens in my business probably more than the other way. You know, we would not have much work to do if we defended only people who were truly innocent.
So from where you sit, are there typical child sex abuse cases, and outside of the celebrity, would this fall into one of those categories?
Typical? No, I don't think – it's hard to separate this from the celebrity and the news coverage and everything that we've seen. But no, this is not necessarily typical. I think what you have are multiple victims, those I think still emerging. You have accusations that are ongoing. And I don't even think we've seen the entire grand jury report. But I think to call something typical like this is probably not accurate. More typically, you might see a single individual who is abused by a step-parent or something along those lines.
Some experts have questioned Sandusky's decision to give a television interview on the topic, where he admitted being in the campus shower with the boys and horse playing. Let's listen to what he had to say.
I have horsed around with kids. I have showered after workouts. I have hugged them, and I have touched their leg without intent of sexual contact.
Do you agree? I was surprised, just as a reporter, as a journalist for 30-odd years, that happened, that interview occurred. Do you agree it was unusual? Or
that's a pretty extraordinary step. Now, it's one thing for an individual accused like he is to release a statement, maybe say, look, we've entered a not guilty plea. I am not guilty. I intend to vindicate myself of these charges. But then he goes into a lot more detail than that and starts to give other information. And that is probably a strategy that, I'm not representing the gentleman, but I would be reluctant to impose that type of strategy.
And it is, of course, Bob Costas.
Right.
Very direct, very forthright, didn't mince words one iota. What about the attorney who was there in the studio with Bob during the interview with Jerry Sandusky over the phone?
Well, again, if I'm going to have my client make a statement, he's going to make a statement. And it's tough for an attorney in a live setting like that to sort of intervene and say, wait a minute, you can't ask that question. And you're right. Bob Costas is not going to mince words. He's going to cut right to the chase, and he's going to put the guy on the spot. That's what he did.
What about just attorneys going into that kind of situation? Again, is this more about the celebrity and do you think, or and that it isn't? In that sense, it's abnormal. Would you go on the air with a reporter?
And I have. I have represented people in various forms that have some celebrity components to it. But you got to be careful what you're doing. And I certainly would be very reluctant to have my client answering questions like that. And I'm sure to some extent it was scripted what he was going to be asked. But no, I would be very cautious about that.
From the point of view of legal representation, are most of your cases a child who claims an adult who says he or she was a victim of abuse as a child? Is that again, I don't want to revert to the black and white of typical or atypical, but is it mostly adults coming out and saying and reporting the abuse?
No, I don't think so at all. I think there's a component of that in our system, and there's laws in our system that allow that to happen beyond certain statutes of limitations. But I think in the main, the cases that I get and the people that I represent are being accused by it's not so distant. There's either been a recent disclosure of a young child, or there's something far more imminent than years past.
My guest is Stephen Palmer. He's a criminal defense attorney at Yavich & Palmer. He represents people who have been accused of child sex abuse. If you have a question or comment for him, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I asked our guest earlier, Beverly Farlow, if the Ohio Revised Code is fair, if it works for victims of child sex abuse. What about the other side of the coin? What is the Ohio Revised Code a fair document in terms of representing people who are accused of the abuse?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think the Ohio Revised Code outlines what the laws are, and certainly it criminalizes, obviously, wrong behavior. In other words, it's a crime to abuse a child in a sexual way or in other ways, for that matter. We often hear, why do these people accused have so many rights, or how do they have constitutional rights? I mean, the truth of it is, anybody accused of sex abuse or abuse of a child in any way, shape, or form doesn't really have any more rights than anybody else. And I think a lot of times there's an alarmist view of these cases, and immediately people are presumed to be guilty. And if you operate understanding that, it helps explain it.
614-292-8513 if you have a question or comment for our guest, Stephen Palmer, attorney, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're running out of time, though, so don't wait. If you have a question, get it in soon. What about the revised code in terms of who's required? In Pennsylvania, they're talking about expanding that list of who's required to report. Is that something that matters to defense attorneys?
Everybody thinks as a defense attorney we're evil, or we shouldn't be doing this, or how do you do this job? But no, it's very important to me that if there's somebody being abused, that it get reported and that they get help and things are done correctly. I think the mandatory reporting rules are good. I think if a physician or a person in some authority catches wind of it, they ought to report it. It's not necessarily their job to investigate it, and it's certainly not their job to prove it, but I think it makes sense to get the ball rolling.
When Bob Costas talked to the attorney on the air the other night, he said, are you sure, you know, do you believe that Jerry Sandusky did not commit these acts? He said he believed that he was innocent. And he said, really, you're not just trying to mitigate his guilt.
Yeah.
Talk about that. What's the difference and how do you do that?
Yeah, it's interesting because there's really two categories of cases. You get people who say they're not guilty, and maybe they're not. And you go to a jury trial and you fight the case from beginning to end. There's other cases where our job is not defined so directly. It's rather to, all right, somebody may have done something, somebody may have committed a crime, and now we have to mitigate what the final punishment will be. And that is, frankly, most of what we do in my line of work. And in the end, I think if I were to evaluate crime across the board, a lot of people get, I think, what they probably deserve. And the laws in this fashion are harsh. The laws about sex abuse are harsh. And I think that's probably okay.
We had a caller who had a question, wanted to know, if someone accuses you of child abuse, do you have the right to know the accuser?
Yeah, you do. If you're going to take the position, actually, no matter what your position is, you always have a right to confront your accuser. You have a right to be notified of the criminal charges against you. And ultimately, there's a discovery process in Ohio that will take place. Names are exchanged. Witnesses are exchanged. Witness statements are exchanged. In fact, the laws have recently been revised to allow even more discovery. So, yeah, we get to know everything.
And how there's been the big issue of false accusations.
Sure.
Because of divorces.
Yes.
And child custody issues. Is that a common part of your practice in terms of this issue?
Yeah, it is. I mean, I see a lot of cases where if somebody were to ask me, is your client guilty? Did he do it in this realm? A lot of them, I would say, I don't know, or I'm not positive, or that's a tough question because there's usually not physical evidence. There's usually not an eyewitness. There's usually not the smoking gun, so to speak. So it's an interesting area in that regard. And if I were to – I've had a few trials over the years that went the wrong way for me, and they still haunt me because I think my client maybe didn't do it. And that's about the hardest thing you can do in my line of work is represent somebody who is actually innocent, and the pressure there is pretty extreme.
Because to be accused and found guilty of something like this is about the worst.
Yeah. I mean, the punishment is typically life in prison, and, you know, there's not much wiggle room there. So.
And that's no picnic for the best of the inmates at the prisons.
Yeah, that's not a real pleasant way to go into the prison system.
A caller from Columbus asked, what do you do when an older teenager, 14 to 15, is the abuser of a younger child? Have you represented somebody like that, or is that strictly?
Oh, no, I have, and it's... It's harder there, and I've represented individuals who are teenagers, who maybe are experiencing with their sexuality at times, and maybe you can almost see a situation where an older teenager might perceive a younger teenager consenting. Now, those are dicier situations. They're done in juvenile court, not adult court, so the penalties aren't nearly as harsh, and the outcome is designed for really the best interest of the child. And you see a more balanced approach at punishment. But, yeah, we see those, and it's a trickier situation. Now, in a situation where somebody's just intentionally abusing somebody, then it's obvious. You know, there's a problem there.
There have been books written on how to interview children who have been sexually abused and how to interview
sure.
them for court. What do you know about that, and how do you approach that task?
Sure. That's the forensic interview, and you hear a lot about it. There's volumes written on it. There's experts who testify about it. I've retained expert psychologists who have helped me deal with that. Typically, it would be done locally anyway, at Children's Hospital. You would see a forensic interview. They're often videotaped. That's sort of a new process here in our jurisdiction, but we look at the videotape, you analyze it, we have experts look at it because it's very, very important how the questions are asked, and it's very important not to suggest answers, and there's a right way and a wrong way to do it, and more we see guidelines that are being promulgated to help interviewers, but you know that is a main area of attack in cases where it's very questionable.
when this case broke last week, I've asked everybody else, what goes through your mind, given the role that you often play in such cases?
Yeah, I mean, I heard somebody say before, everybody was sort of annoyed at the media that they weren't immediately thinking, oh my gosh, what about the children? And that, in a lot of ways, that was going through my mind as well. But then, you know, as a criminal defense attorney, you look at it, and immediately what went through my mind is everybody here is assuming that this gentleman is guilty, and perhaps he is. He may be. But all discussions since have sort of been premised on the fact that he did it. And that's, I guess that's my training and my experience in my profession. And as an attorney, how would one overcome that immediate presumption that has been portrayed in the media? And again, I'm not suggesting he is not guilty or he is guilty, but there's been an immediate assumption that he is.
And maybe putting him on Bob Costas's show isn't what you might have done?
No, I certainly wouldn't have done that.
Jerry in Grove City, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Jerry.
Hello. Since you had the lawyer there, I was wondering if he knows whether there's a legal distinction between having a man and a child in a single shower stall or a man and a child in a communal shower stall such as they normally have at sporting facilities.
I don't know if there's a legal distinction, but certainly a factual distinction. I mean, as far as what the evidence would show, it seems to be far worse for the individual if he's sharing a shower stall and there's an accusation there, as opposed to out in the open where he might be less likely. Or the, you know, why would somebody abuse somebody in the wide open if they're sure to get caught? That would sort of be the defense.
Thanks a lot, Jerry, for that call. How do you think that this case, this kind of a case with this much publicity, could this go on for months?
Oh, I think it could go on for months. Yeah, this will go on for a long time, many months and perhaps years. As I understand it, the whole grand jury report, we don't even know what that is. There's now other alleged victims coming out. I mean, this is going to drag on for a long time. This is going to be a long ride for everybody involved.
Well, I want to thank you for joining us today, Stephen Palmer. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Stephen Palmer is a criminal defense attorney at Yavich & Palmer. And to everybody out there, thank you for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Mm-hmm.